Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
40 years ago, the research submarine Alvin dove deep into the Galapagos Rift and made a stunning discovery. Hydrothermal vents on the ocean floor were surrounded by life forms that thrived near this deep-sea source of energy, minerals, and gases. And that got biologists thinking. Perhaps these vents provided all the necessary ingredients for the first life forms to emerge on Earth. That hypothesis hasn't been proven or disproven, but in the past few years, it's gained some serious competition. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. On land, hot springs and volcanic pools combine many of the same attributes with an important addition, a cycle of wet to moist to dry conditions that may be even more advantageous to the interaction of chemicals and the formation of cell membranes. It's a bold new direction in thinking about the origins of life, and it could have major implications for where we search for living things elsewhere in the universe. David W. Deemer joins us to talk about this. He's a research professor in the Department of Biomolecular Engineering at the University of California, Santa Cruz. You can find his article, Life Springs, in the August issue of Scientific American magazine. Dave, welcome to Think.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This article starts in a place called the Dresser Formation in northwestern Australia, where there are rock formations close to 3.5 billion years old. What was discovered there that makes them such an interesting place to consider the origins of life?
Well, these are some of the oldest rocks on Earth, around 3.5 billion years of age. And some years ago now, Malcolm Walter, who is a Australian scientist at the University of New South Wales, was wandering around there, and he discovered some really interesting-looking circular or spherical rocks that looked like they had layers, almost like onion skin. And little by little, it became apparent that these were fossils of some of the earliest microbes to be alive on the Earth. We can see these today still in the place called Shark Bay, also in that same area of Western Australia. So the idea is that this is really the oldest evidence we have for life on Earth, which is why it was so interesting when Malcolm discovered it.
Is that as early as any hydrothermal environments would have existed on land on the planet 3.5 billion years ago?
Well, we imagine that there would be hydrothermal fields and probably hydrothermal vents at that time of the Earth's history. There's a lot of volcanic activity back then. We do have evidence for that. And wherever there's volcanoes, there would certainly be vents and what we call hydrothermal fields like Yellowstone.
What raw materials would have been necessary given the perfect conditions for life to come into existence anywhere on the planet?
Well, that's a good question. We imagine that there had to be molecules that we called monomers. And today, all life is composed of proteins and nucleic acids, lipids, and carbohydrates. So we imagine that the first life would also have needed some of these monomer molecules, particularly amino acids and what we call nucleotides. These are the subunits of nucleic acids. The lipids are soapy molecules. Most people have blown soap bubbles at some time in their life, and in fact, realize that the soap can form membranous structures, which are the bubbles that we see. If that same soapy stuff is in water, the soap self-assembles all by itself spontaneously into microscopic bubbles. And that's been what I've studied for most of my research career, are these microscopic vesicles that are sometimes called liposomes. We also call them just lipid vesicles. So those are the components that would have been required, we think, for life to begin.
Okay, I want to get to what you were up to in the Kamchatka Peninsula in 2004 in a couple of minutes. But first, I want to talk a little bit about what the Alvin explorers discovered when they were roaming around the bottom of the Pacific Ocean in 1977. What did they see around those hydrothermal ocean vents that got them thinking maybe this is where life started?
Well, Jack Corliss, who in fact just visited us a few months ago, was on the Alvin. And he was the author, first author of the article that came out describing the vents. And what they saw were chimney-like structures coming up out of the ocean's floor along the mid-ocean ridge. And out of the chimney, a black smoke was erupting. These things were anywhere from a few feet to maybe several meters high. And the black smoke, we now know, was a iron sulfide, and other metal sulfides were being ejected from the top of the chimney. A little bit later, after the first publication, Jack, as well as John Barras, who's a colleague of mine up at the University of Washington, thought that they wanted to say, perhaps this is a place where life could have begun. I mean, when you think about it, the ocean is most of the water on Earth, something like 99% of all the water on Earth. The fresh water of Antarctica and Greenland is only about 1%, and then just a very small fraction of that is in lakes such as the Great Lakes and elsewhere on the Earth. So the point is that given that most of the water is the ocean, and life requires water, it's not hard to make the next step in the logic and say perhaps life began in the ocean and the hydrothermal vents were a obvious place to look for the origin of life.
So why has that theory remained in debate all these years, that life began in the oceans? What is not perfect about those conditions for the initial formation of life?
The point is that it's very hard to get down there.
Yeah.
Getting the Alvin down to these places is a very expensive thing to do. So not very many scientists can go down there and actually do an experiment. John Barras is one of those that has, in fact, taken the Alvin down and done some relatively simple experiments just looking for microbial life. Everything else has got to be done in the laboratory as a simulation. And trying to get the pressure and the temperature of the hydrothermal vents, the black smokers anyway, is really a tough thing to do in the laboratory. Fortunately, another kind of vent was discovered by some of the other folks up at University of Washington that we now refer to as alkaline vents. And the alkaline vents are very different from the black smokers. They're not as deep. They are produced by a chemical reaction rather than volcanic activity. And they are not as hot. And they also have life. So interest now has shifted to the alkaline vents. And some of my colleagues in this field are, in fact, trying to simulate alkaline vents in the laboratory. But it really is tough, though. I mean, think of all the stuff that has to go into a simulation. You've got to have the circulating water. It's got to be ideally be seawater, after all. You've got to add material to it. You've got to take a pretty good guess at what might have been present on the early Earth. And then you have to look for chemical reactions. And this is a tremendous analytical problem to get all that together in one place. But a few people have tried. I'm happy to tell you about what their results were.
Well, sure. Talk about that, about the conditions in hot springs and volcanic pools are what this article is focused on. And there have been some really fascinating discoveries, some of which you have made yourself. First of all, tell us what it's like in these places.
Sure. The anybody who's visited Yellowstone has in fact seen the kind of geological site that we're talking about. There are geysers, there are boiling hot springs, there are hot pools. pools that are steaming. The temperature is right up well over 90 degrees, close to boiling, and some of them even at the boiling temperature at that altitude. It's relatively fresh water as opposed to seawater, and that's really an important point. And that's what we bring out in this article, in fact, in Scientific American. Seawater, I'll have to use a couple of scientific terms and then explain those. Seawater is concentrated salt solution. It's about what we call half molar salt. And anybody that's tasted the ocean by going swimming there has, in fact, tasted how salty the ocean is. But it's not just the sodium chloride. There's also salts like calcium chloride and magnesium chloride. They're very important to us, as well as a lot of other minor elements present in seawater. The fresh water of hydrothermal fields that we studied, the volcanic hydrothermal fields, is actually distilled water. It's distilled from the ocean. It falls as rain onto the volcanic land masses, and then it aggregates in hydrothermal pools, such as these hot springs that we see in Yellowstone. So that's one big difference, salty seawater and distilled freshwater that we see in the hydrothermal fields that we study. That makes a big difference in terms of how easy it is to get concentration of the potential reactants and to get encapsulation. Because we think that the first life had to both have concentrated reactants, which are produced very easily in a hot spring setting. You just let the water evaporate. And also encapsulation, which means that there must be a membrane surrounding these reactants that are producing polymeric materials, such as proteins and nucleic acids. So those are the reasons that we are proposing an alternative to the hydrothermal vents, which we just call the hot spring origin of life.
Dave, you're doing such a fantastic job explaining all this to me with my undergrad's amount of science education, and I appreciate that. So I just want to make sure that I'm with you here. The dry spells that happen in these freshwater environments of hot springs and volcanic pools, they're important because they facilitate the formation of these polymers. What is the role of polymers in eventual cell formation?
Well, all life today is based on polymers. Proteins are polymers of amino acids. Nucleic acids are polymers of subunits we call nucleotides. And those are the two primary polymers of all life on Earth. The nucleic acids guide the synthesis of the proteins, which in fact are the machinery of life. These are enzymes that are involved in metabolism and structural materials like we have a protein called keratin that is the skin protein, just for example. The hemoglobin of blood is a protein. When we digest food, we use enzymes, which are all proteins. So that cycle between genetic guidance by the nucleic acids and the synthesis of proteins on little structures called ribosomes, that really is the cycle of life today. And we have to figure out how that cycle got started. So one way to imagine how it could get started is to think about what happens in these hot springs in freshwater hydrothermal fields. And don't forget to ask me, by the way, where all this stuff comes from that I'm going to be talking about.
All right, we will. Let's take a quick break right now, okay. And I'll ask you where it all comes from in just a moment. My guest is David W. Diemer. He's research professor in the Department of Biomolecular Engineering at UC Santa Cruz and co-author of an article called Life Springs in the August issue of Scientific American magazine. If you want to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter. We're @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with David W. Diemer, who's a research professor in the Department of Biomolecular Engineering at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He wrote an article along with two colleagues called Life Springs. It appears in the August issue of Scientific American magazine that explains a lot of what we're talking about today. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Dave, so where do all these proteins, or at least the components that build them, come from around these hot springs that we're talking about?
Well, the honest answer is we are not sure, but we have two possibilities. One is that they are delivered to the Earth during the late accretion of the Earth. And even today, something like 30,000 tons of meteoritic material gets to the Earth on what we call interplanetary dust particles. And they carry organic compounds to the Earth. And as I say, that's happening right now. So we have no problem imagining that something like this happened on the early Earth. The other possibility is that some of it was synthesized at the Earth's surface. And in the 1950s, Stanley Miller, working with Harold Urey at the University of Chicago, found that if he put an electrical spark through a mixture of gases that they thought simulated the atmosphere of the early Earth, that amino acids were produced. That was a real breakthrough at the time, and was pretty much the start of the kind of field that I'm working in now.
This was the idea that people, this was the idea that people had that maybe if lightning struck in the right conditions, life might come into existence.
Well, it was more than that. It takes a lot of lightning to synthesize enough of this material. The other thing is that ultraviolet light can also synthesize organic compounds from simpler material. So we have multiple sources. We know that some of them are happening right now, so they surely were happening 4 billion years ago when we think that life began on the Earth. And we also can simulate in the laboratory, as Stanley Miller did, the sorts of chemistry that could occur at the Earth's surface. So those are the two sources of material that we imagined would accumulate in these hot springs and the pools of a volcanic environment on the early Earth.
So you were far away from your lab in 2004 when you were exploring a volcano in the Kamchatka Peninsula, and you did a little experiment. Talk about what you brought with you.
Yeah, that's something we're still doing. We have a lovely place called Bumpus Hell, which is just up on Mount Lassen, and we're going to be there next month, in fact, doing some research, very much following up on what we did in Kamchatka in 2004. So the idea was to go to one of these hydrothermal fields that we think could have the sorts of chemistry that that would help life begin, and actually do an experiment where we add these molecules, the amino acids, the what we call nucleobases of DNA, and some phosphate and some glycerol, and a fatty acid, which is a lipid-like molecule capable of forming membranes. So we would add this to one of these hot springs and then see what happened to that material over a period of several hours and several days, in fact. What we immediately noticed as soon as the material was added is that a kind of a froth appeared around the edge of this pool. And I knew from the laboratory studies that I'd done with examining this kind of material using a microscope, that that froth was in fact composed of membranes, and the membranes would have encapsulated some of the organic material, the amino acids and nucleobases that I had also added with it. So that was a start of what we're doing now.
So this was a chemical reaction and not a biological reaction with these protocells, these membranes that formed. How close were they to something that you could say was alive?
Oh, it's a long way. What we can say is that under these conditions, encapsulation occurs. So membranes produce little microscopic things we call protocells. And polymerization occurs also. In other words, the amino acids under these conditions form short polymers that we call peptides. And we've found in the laboratory, at least, that when we have nucleotides present, that these also polymerize into a kind of nucleic acid called ribonucleic acid, or RNA. So those two, the encapsulation and the polymerization, is very important because it sets the stage for the next step, and the next step is evolution.
Okay, so evolution happens when what? These nutrients, these polymers, are exchanged across membranes?
Well, I was hoping you'd ask that question.
Oh, good.
It doesn't happen. It doesn't have to be exchange yet. What has to occur in all evolution, starting with Darwin's theory of evolution, published way back in the 1800s, is selection. Selection followed by amplification. And that's happening all the time in the every living thing undergoes a variety of evolutionary processes. The example that Darwin chose to bring his case home is the evolution of domestic animals, for instance. Dogs started with a wolf-like animal some 10,000 or more years ago. And by selection, and this is artificial selection, by selection, by breeders and so forth, we now have everything from Chihuahuas to St. Bernards. So Darwin imagined that a similar kind of selection would go on in the natural world, and that selective processes would choose certain organisms that were able to take advantage of nutrients, of energy, and of the natural circumstances to reproduce themselves, and they would then reproduce and evolve, in fact.
Darwin guessed, you know, more than 150 years ago that life had emerged from some warm little pond. What led him to that hunch long before the mechanisms for how this actually happened were well understood?
Darwin was a very smart guy, of course. We all admire his ability to put patterns together and see patterns that nobody else was able to see at the time. So he took a guess, and I've often thought about what he might have considered to be a warm little pond. And, of course, the English countryside is littered with warm little ponds, and I suppose that he might have had that in his mind. By that time, he had visited the Galapagos, and he might have been thinking also of a saltwater pond that he saw, you know, in the heat of the Galapagos Islands. On the other hand, his pond did not cycle. He had no inkling that cycling, wetting and drying cycles, might be important for the selection and evolution of the earliest forms of life. So he left that out. He knew about proteins, but he did not know about nucleic acids. So that was not part of his speculation. And in fact, this is just a few sentences in a letter that he wrote to his friend Joseph Hooker. He never published that idea. It was discovered later in his letters. So we all still use that, though. And certainly when I talk about what we're doing, we hark back to Darwin's warm little pond, except that we call ours a hot little puddle, and it has to go through this cycling process that we've mentioned.
Okay, so you mentioned that natural selection happens as different, you know, processes and structures are favored, some over others. Is it as these entities are able to reproduce, is that when you can say they're alive, or are we not even close yet?
We can imagine how the first reproduction might have occurred. And in fact, we are now trying to reproduce this in the laboratory. In particular, Jack Szostak at Harvard has been working on this for some number of years, and he's as close as anybody to getting a true replicating system. Another person working on this is Jerry Joyce down at the Salk Institute now, and he's working with RNA. Both of these scientists are working with RNA and trying to get RNA to reproduce itself. And Jack is encapsulating this in a lipid membrane, in fact. So he's really trying to make what we would call a synthetic cell. So if he succeeds, what would happen is that the RNA would have the ability to take nutrients from outside that is just added to the solution. It would cross the membrane and it would be added to the RNA that is already inside these little vesicles. And that RNA would then grow. And as a result of the growth, the protocell would then divide just by a sort of a natural division. It would not be like cells divide today. It'd be a kind of a spontaneous division. So he's seen all of this now in the laboratory. So I think that we are on the way to a system of molecules that looks like a cell. It has the ability to grow using energy and nutrients, and we think it might also have the ability to evolve. So that would be a laboratory version of what we're trying to do in the natural world.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Jim is calling from Carrollton. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how you doing? Dave, I've read this article with a lot of interest, and I got to say, the only problem I see with it is if this is how life arose, then why don't we see that process going on today? Why don't we see these chemicals coming together and forming new life?
Or do we?
Great question. We are seeing it in the laboratory. Darwin, in that same letter, said to Joseph Hooker, that could not happen today because all of this stuff is nutrients for advanced life. So these primitive forms of life, even if they could happen today, would simply get eaten up before they had a chance to really get started. So that's one part of the answer. There's another part, though, and that is that we live in an oxidizing atmosphere today as a result of all the photosynthesis that's been going on for the last 2 billion years. We are in a atmosphere that contains molecular oxygen. This is a pretty reactive chemical, and a lot of the chemicals that I work with in the laboratory, we have to protect from oxygen. And in fact, in my simulations, we put in carbon dioxide as a way to keep oxygen out of the system, because otherwise it would damage the reactants that we're putting in. So that's why this could not happen, at least out in the natural world today. But in the laboratory, that's what we're trying to do.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is research professor in the Department of Biomolecular Engineering at UC Santa Cruz, David W. Diemer. We're talking because he co-authored an article recently in Scientific American magazine called Life Springs. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. All right, let's go back to the phones. This time, another Jim is calling, this one from Dallas. Hey, Jim.
Well, you just basically dealt with the question I had about oxygen. I would like to also ask, though, how oxygen developed in over time, and then at that point, what was the effect on the existing life that had been created up to that point? And I thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Good question, Jim, and I have a little bit of an answer for you. We don't know yet how photosynthesis got started on the early Earth, but we do know that about 2 billion years ago, a kind of microbial organism called cyanobacteria began to produce the oxygen that we now have in the atmosphere. That oxygen, I've often speculated that maybe the first oxygen production was an antibiotic, because in fact, a lot of the organisms today that are what we call anaerobic oxygen is toxic to these. And the cyanobacteria would be successful. That would be a selective factor because they could clear out other microorganisms that were sensitive to oxygen. So oxygen is just a byproduct of photosynthesis. It's not really necessary for the cyanobacteria to live because they use light as an energy source. But again, about 2 billion years ago, another kind of organism developed that was able to use oxygen as an energy source. And that's what we are using today. We are the descendants of those microorganisms that learned how to use oxygen as a way to make energy for itself and infected every cell of our body. Little remnants of these organisms exist. These are called mitochondria. And we can trace our mitochondria right back to some of the very first kind of microbial organisms that learned to use oxygen as a way to produce energy for their metabolism.
So as these microbial organisms became more complex and became multicellular beings, was it animals that emerged before plants, or did they happen simultaneously?
I think that if I had to guess at this, I would say that the equivalent of a plant came first in the form of cyanobacteria. And in fact, we can also trace the green organelles of plants called chloroplasts back to a cyanobacterium that was the original chloroplast way back when. So somehow these got together produce what we now call a eukaryotic organism, organisms with nuclei and mitochondria or chloroplasts, if it's a plant. And this must have happened all about the same time, you know, a couple billion years ago. Plants probably came first, if you're willing to call cyanobacteria a plant. And my guess is that then what we call animal life today began after plants had made oxygen available to support their metabolism.
My guest is David W. Diemer, research professor at UC Santa Cruz, co-author of the article Life Springs in the August Scientific American. You can join our conversation by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with David W. Diemer, research professor in the Department of Biomolecular Engineering at the University of California, Santa Cruz, co-author of a recent article in Scientific American called Life Springs. If you'd like to join us, call 800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. Okay, Dave, if in a place like these volcanic pools, this cycle of wetting and drying and this perfect combination of factors was repeated over and over, and there was this evolution into forms that were more likely to turn into life, to create life, if it happened, as many people think, soon after the correct conditions existed, what does that tell you about how likely it is that life exists elsewhere in the universe?
My estimate of that probability is going up and up and up as the more I work in this field, because so many of the kinds of reactions and processes that we see in the laboratory and that we can now reproduce in natural settings, they're just so simple, really very simple. It's as simple as blowing a soap bubble, just for example. So I think that since we know that there are organic molecules being, throughout our galaxy, they are in what we call molecular clouds from which solar systems are produced, that this would be a relatively common kind of a thing to happen. So I would like to think that places like Mars and Enceladus, which we might talk about a little bit later, have a certain probability. It's not impossible that life could begin elsewhere. And in fact, I'm willing to give maybe 50-50 chance now that there might have been life on Mars in the past, at least.
So tell us about Enceladus. What's up there?
Oh, that's fantastic. Enceladus is a moon of Saturn. It's only about 300 miles across. It's covered with ice, and under the ice we know now is a liquid ocean. It's probably pretty salty. Kept melted by the what we call tidal friction, because as Enceladus goes around Saturn, there's a kind of a heating of the of Enceladus by this by its orbital motion. And that heating then has produced a liquid ocean that occasionally breaks through the ice and produces literally a volcanic plume that we can see jutting out into space. The plume has been visualized by the Cassini mission, and Cassini sent back these extraordinary pictures of the surface of Enceladus with this volcanic plume coming up. And in fact, Cassini flew through the plume, collected some of the material, and sent back an analysis. So we know that there is some organic, very simple organic material present in the plumes. So this really brings us down to the question of whether life could exist in the ocean of Enceladus. And of course, this is really a terribly interesting question, because we just don't know about life elsewhere yet. So the answer is going to be very enlightening. Interestingly, we also have a chance that life began on Mars, a very different setting than Enceladus. Mars was very much like the Earth 4 billion years ago. It had shallow seas, it had a lot of volcanic activity, and there's a good chance that the sorts of conditions that we think were required for life to begin also were present on Mars. So if you like the idea that life began in hydrothermal vents, and some of my colleagues do like that, they are testing that idea, then Enceladus is a possible place for life to have originated and may still be there. And NASA is planning to, at least in the planning stages, planning to get a trip off to Enceladus to sample the plume. And in fact, we're designing one of the instruments that might be able to fly through the plume someday and tell us whether we see what are called biosignatures. But we also are interested in a hydrothermal region of Mars called the Columbia Hills region. And we're pretty certain from work by Jack Farmer and Steve Ruff down at Arizona State University that, in fact, this is a hydrothermal field resembling, in a small, very small dimensions, something like would have been present or is present in some of the hot springs of Yellowstone. So these two places are a definite chance for us to answer the question, can life begin elsewhere? And in fact, does it survive elsewhere? It's right here in our solar system.
Well, that's my next question. Is there any way to speculate what went wrong on Mars? Were the very early life forms that may have existed there somehow more fragile than what existed on Earth? What conditions were so different in the beginning between Mars and Earth that allowed life to flourish here and it appears to die out there if it ever existed at all?
Sure. Let's think about Mars 4 billion years ago. Volcanoes, shallow seas, and that means the temperature was in a range where life could, in fact, exist. It got started there. But over the next 3 billion years, the water slowly evaporated. Mars became drier and drier, colder and colder, and at some point, life could no longer exist on the surface of Mars because there was no liquid water. So that is really what happened to Mars over that same time period. The Earth happened to have much more water. We still have our water. The oceans are all around. And so the Earth was able to not only have life originate, but still thrive in this wonderful planet we call our own.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Robert is calling from Dallas. Hey, Robert.
How are you?
Very well, thanks. Go right ahead, Robert.
Well, my question was, with the varying of humans, from Orientals to Caucasian to black, whatever, and the incredible proliferation of species, hundreds of thousands of variations of spiders, hundreds of thousands of variations of fish, how did all of those variations begin to develop or to branch out and split off? Environment can't be the reason that each one did.
Well, it's a pretty complicated question to try to answer. Darwin gave us the first answer, you know, with natural selection followed by evolution. And, you know, it's still a pretty good answer. We can cause evolution to happen under laboratory conditions in bacterial cultures. We forced evolution to occur in the original wolf, giving rise to what amounts almost, but not quite, to different species of dogs if you compare a Chihuahua and a St. Bernard. And by the way, there is only one human species, Homo sapiens sapiens. There's the slight differences in skin color and physique and so forth are really not speciation at all. They're simply variations induced by the environment that, say, African population lived in compared to a European population. So I would have to get pretty technical if you wanted to talk about mutations and selection and so forth. And but that would be what it would take for me to give you a more detailed answer to your question.
Do you think, Dave, that there is one place on Earth where life emerged and then spread from there? Or is it likely that life spontaneously happened in multiple places way back in the beginning when conditions were right for that?
Yeah, I think there would be lots of volcanic land masses rising through the ocean. They would all have water precipitating on them, just as it happens in Hawaii today, for example. So it's a lot of different places over a period of hundreds of millions of years. We have an example of this in the article that we published in Scientific American. And my colleagues, Tara Jokic and Martin van Kranendonk, visited an area of Western Australia, which we now call the Dresser Formation. And it had originally been thought that this was very likely a marine environment, a shallow, a salty sea where all of these fossils accumulated. But from Terra's discovery of a mineral called geyserite, which is described in the Scientific American article, we're pretty certain now that at least part of this was in fact a freshwater area. And this is a representative going back 3.5 billion years, but you'd still have to go back another 500 million years to get to the point that we think life started, because the life that existed 3.5 billion years ago was already pretty advanced, had protein synthesis, ribosomes, probably DNA and RNA, maybe photosynthesis. So we still have to go back in time to get to the first forms of life. And I think it was probably happening all over the place, wherever there were volcanic land masses rising out of the ocean.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dave, you note that current information about the origins of life is still a little scattered, a little bit like a jigsaw puzzle. You know you have some important pieces, but you don't know yet exactly where to put them. What else do you need to find out definitively that might provide that context?
Yeah, that's a chapter in a book I just completed, in fact. It's going to be published, we hope, sometime next year by Oxford University Press. And I had about 10 gaps in our understanding that we just don't know the answers yet. And they're, some of them are very simple, like how did life become left-handed amino acids and right-handed carbohydrates, and these have to do with what we call chirality, a left-handedness of the amino acids that make up all life today. And the carbohydrates are what we call decarbohydrates, or are right-handed in a sense. So that's just one. And in the absence of this homochirality, life could not exist. So that had to be solved very early on. So that's just one example of a major gap. Another major gap is where ribosomes came from and how genetic code originated. How did DNA learn to make RNA? And how did RNA learn to code for the amino acids as proteins are synthesized by ribosomes? That is a biggie. Some of my colleagues at Georgia Tech, Nick Hudd and Lauren Williams, are addressing that question. I could go on and on. We have so much yet to learn to fill in the middle of the jigsaw puzzle. I like to think of the framework of the jigsaw puzzle, the border, as being the laws of chemistry and physics. Hmm. But the internal portion of the puzzle is still just a mass of pieces that we have to fill in.
Briefly, Dave, before I let you go, we've talked in other episodes of this show about creativity and thought and people having moments of inspiration. I'm curious for you as a scientist, do you have, do you notice that like when you're exercising or walking or cooking, that you have ideas about your work that are sort of in moments that are separate from sitting there in your lab making notes and observations?
Yeah, we really seek those times out. So for me, we live in a little redwood forest up in the hills near Santa Cruz, and there's a beautiful 15 or 20 minute walk that I can take along a stream. And when you want your thoughts to be to yourself and just let your mind roam, that's where I walk. And I understand that Darwin had a much longer walk that he
took.
Hours
every
day,
right?
I think that's, yes, indeed. Oddly enough, I'll give one last little insight here. And that is, we go to scientific meetings. I've been to 3 or 4 already this year. And some of the meeting is exciting and you really want to pay attention. But some of it's, I'm afraid, pretty boring or outside of our field, or we just are not paying attention. And that's another place, for me anyway, that my mind wanders and I make sure to have a notebook and jot down those ideas as they come tumbling out. So that's where some of my inspiration comes from.
David W. Deamer studies biomolecular engineering at UC Santa Cruz, and he's a co-author of the article Life Springs in the August Scientific American magazine. David, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.